Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The machine knows you're lying! I know you're lying! Tell me the truth! Tell me the truth!
The sounds of torture on the hit Fox television show 24. The dean of West Point has said the show's encouraging U.S. soldiers to abuse detainees in Iraq. We'll speak with a military interrogator who met with Fox to ask them to stop. Then the Army responds to conditions at the Walter Reed Medical Center.
I have never been made aware of Building 18, its condition, or complaints by any of our wounded warriors over the last 5 years.
Mouse droppings, cockroaches, stained carpets, rodents, and black mold. Those are the findings of a Washington Post investigation into Walter Reed Hospital. We'll speak with a reporter for Salon.com who did a Walter Reed expose 2 years ago. And terrorist attacks have increased by 600% since the U.S. invaded Iraq. We'll look at a new study. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The so-called coalition of the willing in Iraq has shrunk even further. Two members announced withdrawals Wednesday, while a third says it's considering following their lead. British Prime Minister Tony Blair's announcement of a pending withdrawal of 1,600 British troops was followed by another announcement from Danish Prime Minister Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
In August, the Danish battalion will be withdrawn and replaced by a number of helicopters. And at the same time, we have decided to increase the number of Danish troops in Afghanistan.
Denmark has nearly 500 soldiers in Iraq under British command. The announcement came as Lithuania said for the first time it's seriously considering withdrawing its contingent from Iraq when its mission ends later this year. Denmark's withdrawal will leave just 23 nations with a presence in Iraq, down from 49 when the war began. Within hours of the troop withdrawal announcements, Pentagon officials said plans are in place to send more than 14,000 National Guard members back to Iraq next year. Most would be returning to Iraq, having spent less time back home between deployments than ever before. On a visit to Japan, Vice President Dick Cheney issued what some called a tacit criticism of Britain's withdrawal.
I want you to know that the American people will not support a policy of retreat. We want to complete the mission, we want to get it done right, and then we want to return home with honor.
Cheney was speaking aboard a U.S. aircraft carrier near Tokyo. From there, he headed to Australia, where protests had already begun ahead of his visit. In Sydney today, hundreds of people turned out for a march through the city center. 10 people were arrested when a crowd of more than 200 tried to converge on the U.S. consulate. In Iraq, at least 3 people were killed and 25 wounded Wednesday when a truck carrying chlorine exploded in Baghdad. Meanwhile, another U.S. Black Hawk helicopter was shot down over Baghdad. The Pentagon says the 9-member crew escaped with no injuries. Meanwhile, 4 Iraqi soldiers have been accused in the second sexual assault allegation against Iraqi forces this week. An Iraqi official says the soldiers raped a 50-year-old Sunni woman, then tried to rape her 2 daughters last week. This follows Monday's report that 2 members of the Shia-led police force raped a Sunni woman during the massive security crackdown on Baghdad. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki initially backed an investigation, but later dismissed the charges and accused the woman of spreading propaganda. The International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to report today Iran has failed to properly suspend uranium enrichment. A 60-day deadline expired Wednesday. In Germany, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged Iran to change course.
Taking this opportunity, I would strongly urge the Iranian authorities to comply, first of all, fully with Security Council resolution and continue to negotiate with the international community, particularly European Union.
Iran has vowed to continue nuclear activities, but says it's open to unconditional talks. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice defended the Bush administration's refusal to talk to Iran without a suspension of enrichment.
pressure on the Iranian regime is so that the Iranian regime can make better choices about how to engage the international community. I would reiterate as well that in May of last year, the Bush administration offered to reverse 27 years of American policy to engage in the context of the six with our Iranian counterparts. I've said I would meet my Iranian counterpart any place, anywhere, anytime, should the Iranians decide to suspend.
In Italy, Prime Minister Romano Prodi resigned Wednesday after losing a parliamentary vote on his foreign policy. Dissident members of Prodi's coalition voted to rebuke him over the expansion of a U.S. military base in Italy and his determination to keep Italian troops in Afghanistan. Prodi could still return to office if he's able to form a new government. In Norway, more than 40 countries are gathering today for an international conference on banning the use of cluster bombs. This is Mark Julin, General Director of Belgium's Handicap International.
Throughout the world, we know of some 21 countries which are still polluted with cluster bomblets, and the estimates go towards some 33 million undetonated bomblets that are still lying around.
The Oslo Conference on Cluster Munitions was spearheaded by the Norwegian government to draw attention to the thousands of deaths attributed to cluster bombs each year. Peter Buchert, Emergencies Director of Human Rights Watch, addressed the consequences from Israel's attack on Lebanon last year.
Israel used as many cluster bombs in just a small area of southern Lebanon than the U.S. and coalition forces used in all of Iraq during a much longer conflict. So southern Lebanon was literally sown with cluster bombs. There was, after the war ended, there was really no safe place to go where you didn't have to look down on the ground and worry about unexploded cluster bombs.
Meanwhile, in Lebanon, the Bush administration's being accused today of preventing the rebuilding of damaged areas from Israel's attack. On Tuesday, the Treasury Department branded a leading construction firm in southern Lebanon a terrorist group. The firm, Jihad al-Bina, is linked to Hezbollah. Hezbollah says the company's independent and involved strictly in construction activities. In a statement, U.S. Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Stuart Levy said the firm is being targeted in part because it's used, quote, to attract popular support through the provision of civilian construction services. Hezbollah says the firm has restored at least 11,000 homes destroyed by Israeli attacks since 1993. Back in the United States, jury deliberations began Wednesday in the perjury and obstruction trial of Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Libby is accused of lying to investigators and a grand jury during the investigation of the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. In South Dakota, a new attempt to ban abortion has been defeated in the state Senate. On Wednesday, the Senate State Affairs Committee voted to reject a bill that would permit abortion only to prevent the death of a woman or in severely restricted cases of rape or incest. The 8-1 vote marked the third victory in 4 years over efforts to ban abortion in South Dakota. Immigrant rights groups are accusing the Bush administration of holding immigrant families in prison-like conditions at two detention centers in Pennsylvania and Texas. In a report set for release today, the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children and the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service say immigrant children have been separated from their parents and sometimes denied proper medical care, food, and education. The report follows a federal inspection last month at five of the nation's detention centers. Investigators found the centers failed to provide timely and responsive health care and fell short of other government standards. And finally, there'll be at least one notable seat change when the new White House press room opens in May. Veteran correspondent Helen Thomas will no longer be occupying her place in the front row. Thomas has covered every U.S. president dating back to John F. Kennedy. She'll be moved to the second row to make way for an undetermined cable news channel. Thomas says she's accepted the change, saying, quote, "You have to submit to the will of the people, and apparently this is the will of my peers. It's okay with me. I've had a good run in the front seat." Both CNN and Fox have expressed interest in moving up to the front row. If so, Fox will occupy both the front row of the press corps and the podium. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow is a former Fox anchor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. A top Army general admitted on Wednesday there's been a breakdown in leadership at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The comments of General Richard Cody, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, came 3 days after the Washington Post revealed that hospital rooms at Walter Reed were infested with mouse droppings, cockroaches, stained carpets, rodents, and black mold. General Cody said no one has been fired or relieved of command because of the neglect of the neglected facility, but he vowed that the Army would immediately fix the problems.
I have never been made aware of Building 18, its condition, or complaints by any of our wounded warriors over the last 5 years. That is not an excuse by any shape or form. Clearly, we've had a breakdown in leadership and a bureaucratic, medical, and contractual processes bogged down a speedy solution to these problems. I can assure you that the appropriate vigor and leadership is being applied to this issue, and we will correct any problems immediately.
General Richard Cody, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff. While the Washington Post investigation has attracted the attention of President Bush and top Army officials, it is not the first time the press has exposed problems at Walter Reed. 2 years ago, Salon.com began publishing a series of articles by Mark Benjamin on how soldiers receiving outpatient treatment for mental wounds were suffering from a shocking pattern of neglect. This is Mark Benjamin speaking on Democracy Now! In March 2005.
What I found was that at Walter Reed, there's an interesting thing going on, and this seems to be the case at other military facilities. Soldiers from this war who suffer acute wounds, amputees, head injuries, bullet wounds, you know, people that are blown up by roadside bombs, get excellent medical care, or that's what they report to me. They get off those battlefields very, very quickly. They're brought back to Walter Reed. You'll see them. You will see their, you know, good news stories on TV where reporters are allowed to see them rehabilitating there at Walter Reed. What is interesting about that is that soldiers who are hurt in their mind, soldiers who have debilitating, really scary post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking about people that are acutely homicidal, acutely suicidal after what they've seen or had to do in Iraq, their treatment, the way they describe their treatment at Walter Reed is extremely substandard. They don't get the kind of therapy they deserve. They don't get one-on-one therapy. They're treated by not even doctors, they're medical students. And the entire time that they're at Walter Reed, the Army seems to be more bent on trying to determine that their problems were not, in fact, caused by the war, and that, in fact, these soldiers were just crazy of their own accord.
Mark Benjamin, the national correspondent of Salon.com, speaking on Democracy Now! In March of 2005, almost 2 years ago. At the time, Walter Reed officials refused to discuss Salon's findings. Instead, they issued a statement saying, quote, "We're satisfied there is a very high level of patient satisfaction with their treatment." Mark Benjamin joins us now live from Washington, D.C. And joining us on the phone from Knoxville, Tennessee, we have retired Army veteran First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum. He was treated at Walter Reed for 2 years. And we're also joined on the phone from Chesterfield, South Carolina, by Annette McLeod, wife of National Guardsman Del McLeod, who was treated for almost a year at Walter Reed. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Mark Benjamin, can you start by responding to what the Washington Post has exposed and the Army's response?
Well, I think the Washington Post did an excellent job of covering two subjects. One is the obvious dilapidation of some of the facilities at Walter Reed, which is a problem there for the outpatients. And also, I think that they did a good job of exposing how soldiers, and I think Lieutenant Goodrum, I know his case relatively well, can describe, which is where people are, particularly people with injuries that aren't as obvious, you know, people that don't have a leg missing, but people who are suffering from, say, post-traumatic stress disorder, can really languish there at Walter Reed for, in some cases, years while they're struggling to get proper treatment, proper care, and proper compensation for their injuries. So I think they did a good job. I think with respect to the response from the military, to be completely frank, it has me rather concerned. There's a lot of discussion from the Pentagon about taking care of this mice and mold problem, which of course there shouldn't be mice, you know, in a building where soldiers are recuperating. That, to me, to be completely frank, is a bit of a red herring. I mean, you know, fixing the mold in one building is just
not what really the big problem here. What is the big problem, as far as I can tell, among the soldiers who are recuperating there, is they want to be promptly treated for their problems, promptly and accurately diagnosed for their problems, and they want to be fairly compensated for their injuries, which are service related. That is the nasty bureaucracy that the Washington Post uncovered. And I'm, to be completely frank, really concerned that the way that the military so far has responded to this is, we're going to throw some more paint up on the walls, we're going to fix that in this one building, Building 18. That's great and wonderful, and of course those soldiers seem to deserve that. But the real problem here is a system that, if you don't, as I said 2 years ago, if you have an injury that is not obvious, a traumatic brain injury, which can be extremely debilitating, Annette can talk about that, or post-traumatic stress disorder, which, yes, can be very dangerous. I think Lieutenant Goodrum can talk about that. Those are the kinds of soldiers who want to be treated and want to be compensated and are fighting unfairly to get that.
And Mark, in terms of this whole issue of once they're there at Walter Reed, often I've interviewed soldiers who have waited months and months in the battle over determining the extent of compensation and how much of a disability they will have. It becomes a huge and drawn out process in a battle for them. What could be done to change that whole procedure?
I'm glad you asked that. To me, that's one of the most important issues. It's not as sexy, as I said, as the mice and mold issue, but there is a fundamental problem, or my reporting seems to show a fundamental problem. The way it works is when you are injured or hurt serving in Iraq, for example, and you come back to a place like Walter Reed, two things are happening at the same time. The Army is trying to do both. On the one hand, the Army is trying to help you heal, to treat, for example, your post-traumatic stress disorder. On the other hand, the same Army is trying to make a determination about how much money the Pentagon is going to pay that soldier, perhaps for the rest of their life. Now, the Army's mission, you have to understand, is to take ground and hold it. The Army's mission, frankly, is not to compensate veterans for their service. So what we have is essentially a conflict of interest. The Army is trying to do both at the same time, save money for bullets and bombs on the backs of veterans, and also treat them and compensate them. So it's this strange problem, and in my reporting suggests that those two missions are conflicted, and the person who is suffering is the veteran. So the veteran is essentially, their medical care is getting mixed up in their compensation. A simple example is somebody who appears to have post-traumatic stress disorder ends up getting diagnosed with something called personality disorder not otherwise specified. In other words, it's not our fault you have mental problems, it's your fault you came to the Army that way. I see that all the time. To be totally honest, if I could wave a magic wand, I would take the ability of the Army to be in the business of compensating soldiers out of their hands. I just don't think they should be. It just does. My reporting suggests they shouldn't be in the business at all. You know, let the VA do it, an organization that is dedicated solely to treating and compensating veterans, because frankly, I just think the Army is conflicted here about handing out money.
I want to turn to First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, treated at Ward 54 and Walter Reed for 2 years. Mark wrote a piece about you, and it begins, Groucho Marx once said that military justice is to justice what military music is to music. Lieutenant Julian Goodrum laughs at that quote. It's crazy, the 35-year-old Army reservist and Iraq vet says about his knockdown, drag-out fight with the Army. It pushed him to the edge physically, emotionally, and financially. I have to laugh, otherwise I'd go crazy, he said. Well, First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, Mark Benjamin is writing about you. Tell us what happened to you.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show. To my dismay, and to be honest, I still have problems actually believing what I encountered was actually true. But fortunately, I was called in I actually found myself in a system that basically, as far as treating soldiers, was illegal and unethical for myself trying to receive the proper and mainstream medical care, and also to be diagnosed properly and to be rated justly and fairly. Give one example. During my stay at Walter Reed, during one time, I had homicidal in Tennessee. I went to my treating psychiatrist and told him, hey, I'm having some real serious problems here. I'm thinking about killing. And his response was, there's nothing I can do for you. You will be held fully accountable for your actions. So on that note, I sought treatment at a local vet center, which is ran by the VA in Silver Springs, Maryland. Another great, great example of the medical board is another psychiatrist I had. Unfortunately, you obtain psychiatrists is probably, they rotate every 3-4 months. But one of them kept asking me about alcohol. Did I drink? I kept saying, no. And after he rotated on, I came under care of a civilian psychiatrist, Walter Reed, and I told her the conversation. And she said, good for you. She said, this is what they do. If they can get you or prove that you drink, even just one or two beers, they'll put you in the Army's, there's a 3-week alcohol program at Walter Reed. From that, that documentation goes in your medical file. And most patients with PTSD have a dual diagnosis of major depression disorder. So when the board is looking at a percent for rating you for a major depression, they'll see the form in there that she was in an alcohol program. They'll turn to the doctor and say, doctor, can a depression be, can alcohol cause depression? They'll say yes. Okay, his depression is self-induced, 0%. So it's just several examples of things soldier faces. For example, my
First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, we have to break. But when we come back, I want to ask what happened when you sought treatment at a civilian hospital and how the military then responded. First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum was treated at Ward 54 in Walter Reed for 2 years. We'll also be back with Mark Benjamin and speak with the wife of a soldier who was treated at Walter Reed for almost a year. Stay with us.
Make you not go anywhere. Just wait till they make I tell you something. Don't
Unknown Soldier by Fela Kuti here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the revelations that the Washington Post has just revealed in a series of investigations of Walter Reed Hospital. We're talking to Mark Benjamin, who had been focusing on Walter Reed Hospital now for years, along with First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, treated at Ward 54 in Walter Reed for 2 years. Now, when you left after being dissatisfied with the treatment at Walter Reed, Julian Goodrum, you went to a Knoxville, Tennessee psychiatric hospital, a civilian hospital. The Army subsequently accused you of desertion because you had been turned away from the military hospital but went into a civilian hospital?
That's absolutely correct. Actually, I was, which they confirmed through medical documentation and testimony, that I was denied a medical treatment at Fort Knox, Kentucky, but it was a misunderstanding. When I sought treatment, I was in the midst of a what I know now to be a point of dysfunction, otherwise known as a nervous breakdown. I sought treatment at an inpatient a psychiatric hospital in Knoxville, Tennessee, which received great care, and they was able to get me stable in a week and a half. But from that, the Army was contacted that I was inpatient, my diagnosis, but yet they still considered me AWOL, and actually had at one time alleged charges for a desertion.
And now, Lieutenant, you'd been in the military for 16 years, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And in one of the things I've heard from many veterans is that sometimes the whole situation of their medical treatment is used sometimes as retaliation against possible things that may have happened while in the military. I know Mark Benjamin at one point wrote a piece that said that you had blasted superiors for misdeeds that you said cost a soldier's life. Did that have anything to do, in your sense, with the way you were being treated?
Yes. The evidence, as far as Army documentation and email, definitely gives the appearance, at the minimum, the appearance that my safety concerns and equipment concerns in Iraq was part of the foundation for their illegal and unethical behavior. But personally, I say yes.
And Mark Benjamin, have you found that to be the case with some of the other soldiers you've interviewed, the use of retaliation in terms of the way that soldiers are dealt with in terms of medical treatment?
Well, certainly, I think, you know, what Lieutenant Goodrum is talking about is when a soldier who has a stellar career sees something that they think is wrong in theater, say in Iraq, and tries to alert superiors and tries to do the right thing and ends up resulting in this case, in the death of a young soldier. And in Goodrum's case, which I think is very well documented, it ends up that there's a lot of retribution against the soldier, and it's carried out through his medical care, and it's carried out through charging him with AWOL for trying to go get psychiatric care. I think those cases are relatively unusual. They do happen. I mean, being a whistleblower in the military, stepping up and doing, frankly, what officers are taught to do, which is blow the whistle when things get out of hand, yes, there are serious, serious cases of retaliation, and you do come across them. I think the bigger problem, though, and I think Lieutenant Goodrum can speak to both of those, is you have those situations where you have somebody who tries to blow the whistle about dangerous equipment or lack of equipment, so on and so forth. But then you get into this other issue of this frightening sort of bureaucracy, where the military is A, trying to treat you, and B, trying to determine if they can compensate you, or, and I think a lot of soldiers would say, not compensate you. By trying to save money and doing those at the same time. And when you mix all that stuff together, and for example, in Lieutenant Goodrum's case, you have a very nasty recipe where a soldier is both being retaliated against and struggling against a bureaucracy that is set out to primarily, or my reporting suggests, primarily save money on long-term disability payments and not so much emphasizing medical care.
I want to bring Annette MacLeod into this conversation, wife of Del MacLeod. Before he was deployed to Iraq, he worked in the rural steel and textile mills of South Carolina. Can you talk about what has happened to your husband since returning from Iraq?
My husband is no longer the man that he was when I married him. It's almost like the day that he was injured, he actually died and had rebirth as a different man.
Can you elaborate? Can you tell us what happened when he came back, when he started his treatment at Walter Reed Hospital?
Well, before the accident, my husband was very easygoing. He was well-liked, very quiet, very laughable. He would laugh at just the least little thing. Now he's angry. He's aggressive. It's like I told his psychiatrist and his psychologist, it's almost like he's angry, and he vents everything toward me. It's like I don't know him anymore. He's angry at the system, but he knows he's powerless. At the same time, he knows that if something's not done, he's not going to recuperate.
Could you tell us a little bit what was the nature of his injury? I understand he suffered some brain damage. What happened in Iraq, and then when he came back to the hospital, what kind of treatment he got?
Well, he was pulling inventory on an 18-wheeler, and first of all, the door was strapped off by a hamburger bun sack instead of the nylon straps that they're supposed to use. He was pulling the inventory when the wind got behind the door, and the door actually struck him, sending him airborne through the air. From that, they didn't realize that he had a brain injury, didn't bother to check, didn't bother to run x-rays. They did, however, run x-rays of the lower back at the time. He was not medevaced immediately. He was put on watch in quarters so that because he couldn't lift anything, he couldn't move. When he come back to Walter Reed, he was never inpatient. The day that I saw him, it was like by talking to him, I knew something was wrong. He was very argumentative. It was almost like you had to prove everything to him. He was angry. He was always looking at me like I was the enemy. And this was a guy that we just celebrated our 21st anniversary. So when you don't know somebody anymore, something's wrong. And I tried to tell them at Walter Reed. I talked to his social worker. I talked to his case manager. I talked to his doctors. And I kept telling them, I said, something is wrong. This is not my husband.
Annette, Ann Hull and Donna Priest of the Washington Post began one of their pieces, their exposés, called Injured Vets Now Battle for Benefits, with the story of your husband, Del. They say one day he's led on stage at a Toby Keith concert with dozens of wounded Operation Iraqi Freedom troops from Malone House, and the next he's sitting in a cluttered cubbyhole at Walter Reed, fighting the Army for every penny of his disability. What is your major concern right now? What are you demanding of the Army and Walter Reed?
Well, we were fortunate. By the help of a staffer, he got 50% from the Army. However, they did not rate his brain injury. They rated the cognitive dysfunction from the brain injury, and he got more for anxiety than he did for any of the other injuries. However, their thinking is they rated him 30% for the anxiety. They would not classify him as PTSD. The thing is, they're saying that this may get better with time, and then if it does, so-called in time, then he'll wind up with nothing.
Well, Annette MacLeod, we're going to leave it there. We thank you very much for being with us, but we do want to follow what happens with your husband, Del MacLeod, has been treated at Walter Reed for almost a year. First Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, thanks so much for being with us, treated at Ward 54 and Walter Reed for 2 years. And Mark Benjamin, national correspondent at Salon.com, thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Juan?
Well, as the fourth anniversary of the Iraq War approaches, new concerns are being raised over the effect the war has had on global security. A new study by Mother Jones magazine has found that the number of fatal terrorist attacks has increased by over 600% since the U.S. invaded Iraq. The effect of the war has been felt from London to Kabul and from Madrid to the Red Sea. The study contradicts key claims by President Bush that the Iraq War has made the world safer.
From the start, America and our allies have protected our people by staying on the offense. The enemy knows that the days of comfortable sanctuary, easy movement, steady financing, and free-flowing communications are long over. For the terrorist life since 9/11 has never been the same.
President Bush speaking at a State of the Union address last month. Paul Cruikshank is co-author of the new study, The Iraq Effect, The War in Iraq and Its Impact on the War on Terrorism. He's a research fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Summarize your findings, Paul.
Well, you know, the Bush administration has argued that the war in Iraq has sort of diverted jihadists to Iraq, a bit like moths to a flame. Our study suggests that if Iraq is a flame, it's a flame which is reignited a global jihad. We find a 607% increase in fatal jihadist attacks around the world, a 237% increase in fatalities. Outside Afghanistan and Iraq, the two major hotspots for jihadist terrorism, there's been a 35% increase in jihadist attacks, and there's been a 25% increase in attacks on Western targets since the war in Iraq. So we've seen quite remarkable rises in jihadist terrorism in the period after the war in Iraq. Now, our study looked at two periods. It looked at the first period between 9/11 and the US invasion of Iraq on March 20, 2003. And then the second period is the period afterwards. And we've seen these large rises in terrorism. These are simply the metrics that we've looked at.
Now, one question in terms of how you define terrorism, because obviously a large number of the attacks are coming in Iraq. Do you define it in terms of attacks on civilians, or do you also include attacks on soldiers as well, let's say American troops in Iraq? Or?
Well, terrorism as defined is always attacks on civilians, obviously. A terrorist attack is an attack on a civilian entity, so we're only looking at those attacks, and we're only looking at attacks by Sunni jihadist groups which are either directly related to al-Qaeda or share their ideology. We excluded groups from Palestine. We were only looking at groups which were very close to al-Qaeda, either directly or in terms of ideology. In terms of that anti-American ideology, which is obviously the United States is extremely concerned about. So you've had remarkable rises in these terrorist attacks. And we only looked at fatal terrorist attacks. We didn't just look at every old attack. We looked at the serious ones, and we see these very large rises. Just to give you an example, in the Arab world, there's been a 445% increase in jihadist terrorist attacks since the Iraq War, and there's been a 783% increase in fatalities. There have been 12 attacks in Saudi Arabia since the war in Iraq. In the period before that, we considered there were none. There's been a wave of attacks in Egypt. In confessions of those perpetrators, of people who attacked those targets in the Red Sea areas in the last few years, they've said the war in Iraq was our main motivating factor. We wanted to punish Westerners for the actions over there.
Paul Cruikshank, you write that there are, just in 2006 alone, 118 suicide attacks in Afghanistan, more than in the entire history of the country. What relation do you think those attacks have to the war in Iraq?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, certainly the suicide terrorism in Afghanistan has gone through the roof. And if you look at when the Taliban terrorist campaign starts in Afghanistan, it really gets going at September 2003. And, you know, this isn't in 2001, it's not in 2002, when US troops were already there. They start attacking civilian entities, Afghan police entities in September 2003. That's after the US invasion of Iraq. And what basically happened is that they were inspired in part by Iraqi jihadists launching a campaign there. Now, the tactic that worked remarkably well for Iraqi jihadists attacking civilians, attacking the US there, was suicide bombing. And so, you know, you have Afghan internet sites based in Peshawar, Pakistan, which say look, guys, we need to copy the tactics that you're using in Iraq. We need to export these to Afghanistan. And so it was a very consciously thought out strategy to use suicide attacks. Also, remarkably, the higher increase of improvised explosive devices in Afghanistan, too. And so what we found is the Iraq war, that the jihadist experience in Iraq of finding the best army in the history of the world, the US Army, has sort of allowed them to pioneer new tactics which have been exported elsewhere. There's been evidence that Taliban fighters and Pakistani militants as well have even traveled to Iraq to get what one Pakistani journalist observed as on-the-job training, going to train with Zarqawi, coming back to Afghanistan, and using their terrorism savoir-faire to launch new attacks there.
And in terms of this, obviously in Europe and the United States, an enormous amount of money has been spent in building up protection against terrorism and security, and the Bush administration is always saying, hey, we haven't had another attack since 9/11. What's your sense of the difference between what's going on in Europe and the United States and the rest of the world?
Well, in Europe, there's much more of a problem of radicalization amongst the Muslim community than there is in the United States, and there are all sorts of reasons for that. You know, United States Muslims earn a lot more on average than the average American citizen. They're incredibly well integrated, educated, so on and so forth. It's very unlikely we'll get any homegrown terrorism in the United States. But there is clearly still a threat to the United States from people traveling over, for example, from Europe. They can travel pretty easily to the United States. There's still a threat there. And Osama bin Laden in January 2006, he released an audio tape and he responded directly to Bush's assertion, President Bush's assertion, that the war in Iraq was diverting al-Qaeda from its central purpose of attacking the United States. Osama bin Laden said this. He said, it's not diverting us. We're still absolutely determined to attack the United States. And actually, the war in Iraq has given us more recruits. And he said, you will expect, we are plotting attack against you right now. Just last summer, you had an airline plot based from London, which could have killed thousands. And that was perhaps the operation he was referring to. So there still is a threat to the United States.
Paul Cruickshank, last question about Saudi Arabia.
What about Saudi Arabia is your question? Well, clearly, Saudi Arabia is probably the country which will suffer most from the blowback from Iraq. You know, it borders Iraq. A lot of its young citizens have traveled over to Iraq to fight there and will eventually come back. They're already making dozens of arrests. They're very, very worried. Saudi officials told us they're very worried that there'll be a huge blowback in Saudi Arabia. There'll be a wave of new terrorist attacks in the kingdom. They're trying to get ready for that. And so there's large concern in Saudi Arabia over the impact of the Iraq war for them.
All right, I lied. Last question, 10 seconds. What would attack on Iran mean for increased terrorist threats?
Well, it would mean nothing in terms of al-Qaeda. I mean, al-Qaeda is a Sunni organization, but clearly there's a danger that a totally different form of terrorism could come from Iran in terms of state sponsoring. But it doesn't mean anything in terms of al-Qaeda. It's a whole different kettle of worms.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Paul Cruickshank, fellow at NYU Law School Center on Law and Security. And we'll link to that new study at democracynow.org, The Iraq Effect, the war in Iraq and its impact on the war on terrorism. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we look at Fox's hit show 24 and its links to torture in Iraq. Stay with us.
Teacher, teacher, did you not behave? Did you teach the children war is not okay? Why are you packing up your stuff? Did they ship you out to shut you up? What's happening here? Soldier, soldier, did you lose a limb? Based on a rich man's will. Where are all your benefits? Did they fund the tax cuts for the rich? What's happening here? Don't you know you gotta rise up, seek the truth, shout out now. What's happening here? What's happening here? Shine a light on what you know is right, right here, right now. And say it clear, what's happening?
Jamie Green what's happening here. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Is torture on television encouraging U.S. soldiers to abuse detainees?
Just tell me what I need to know. How do I find McCarthy? Damn you. Damn you. Four CCs.
That's 8 CCs total, Jack. His vitals are spiking across the line.
Four CCs! The machine knows you're lying. I know you're lying. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth.
That's a scene from 24, the hit television series on the Fox television network with a weekly audience of 15 million viewers. Each season of 24 depicts an impossibly tense day in which counterterrorism agent Jack Bauer has just 24 hours to stop a terrorism plot that endangers the country. Faced with this ticking time bomb scenario, Bauer invariably chooses to torture, to force suspects to divulge critical information.
Some of the torture tactics on 24 include drugging, waterboarding, electrocution, or power drilling into a man's shoulder. In 5 seasons of the show, there have been no less than 67 torture scenes, according to the Parents Television Council. That's more than one every show.
This past fall, the dean of West Point, Brigadier General Patrick Finnegan, along with experienced military and FBI interrogators and representatives of Human Rights First, flew to Southern California to meet with the creative team behind 24 to tell them to stop using torture because American soldiers were copying the show's tactics. The first meeting was revealed this month by the New Yorker magazine.
Well, the Philadelphia Inquirer reports the show has decided to cut back on torture, not because of complaints, but they say because it's become something of a cliché. Tony Lagaranas is one of the former Army interrogators who met with the show's writers in November. He served for a year in Iraq, joins us in the studio from Chicago. And in our Firehouse studio, we're joined by David Danzig, director of the Primetime Torture Project for Human Rights First. He was also in the group that met with the producers of 24. We asked Joel Cerno, the creator of 24, or any representative from the show to be on the program, but they declined our request. Tony Lagaranas, tell us why you met with the 24 producers to talk about your concerns.
Well, when David Danzig from Human Rights First asked me to go out there and speak to them, I thought it was a good idea because I did see interrogators copying some of the methods and the posture of not specifically 24, but certainly television programs, which increasingly have gotten more egregious with regard to torture.
What did you see? Explain what you saw in Iraq and where you were.
Well, the problem was that when we were interrogating in Iraq in 2004, we were being told that Geneva Conventions didn't apply. So we didn't have training that informed us what to do anymore because we were taught according to Geneva Conventions. So people were getting ideas from television. And among the things that I saw people doing that they got from television was waterboarding, mock execution, using mock torture. They wanted to hook up one of our translators to an electric generator and pretend that they were torturing him and allow prisoners to see that so that they thought that they would experience the same thing.
Did you see them?
These were techniques.
Did you see soldiers watching 24 in Iraq?
I wasn't aware of the show 24 in Iraq, but I do remember seeing people watching television shows that depicted torture. 24 might have been one of them.
David Danzig, I'd like to ask you, it's not just 24, obviously, it's the worst example, but you've been documenting now an enormous increase in torture on television compared to before 9/11. Could you talk about that and what led you to start this campaign?
That's right. It's really quite shocking when you look at the way that television deals with torture now as opposed to before 9/11. Before 9/11, there was an average of about 4 scenes of torture on television in prime time. Post 9/11...
Per year.
Mm-hmm. Post 9/11, that number has jumped to more than 100. But what's particularly disturbing for us about this is that when you look at who's doing the torturing, the people who are involved in it have changed. It used to be the bad guys were the ones who tortured, the Nazis or aliens or something like that, and torture never worked. But now it's people like Jack Bauer, it's the heroes of these shows, Sydney on Alias, and it always works for these people. So the message that 18, 19, 20-year-old soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan get is that good guys use this stuff and it works.
And invariably, the issue is that the nation's security is at stake. And
it's very seductive to see Jack Bauer every Monday night save the world by using these sorts of tactics. The suggestion isn't that these sorts of tactics are easy or pretty, but the suggestion is that they work and they make you a hero.
Talk about the meeting, David. Who did you meet with Fox, with 24? And we're sorry we weren't able to get anyone from 24 to be on the broadcast, and their response.
Well, we brought Tony and two other very experienced interrogators, as well as Brigadier General Patrick Finnegan, who is the dean of West Point, to talk to the executive producer of 24 and several of their lead writers. And really, our point in bringing them there was to talk to them about the way in which they showed torture. Our view is that it's really quite boring what you see on 24. Torture happens, as you say, almost every episode, and Jack Bauer steps up and bam, bam, bing, uses torture and gets the effects. It almost always works. What we were saying to them is, in the real world, it's not like that. And the trouble is that what you're suggesting with your show is that it could be or should be. And so our point was to try and provide them some real-world basis for showing torture. We were suggesting to them, hey, what if you made it more like real life, if torture took place and bad things happened as a result? What if, for example, the person who was tortured gave out the false information, or the person who was being tortured was killed? That would lead to a whole area that would be much more interesting, we said, and much more realistic, and wouldn't have this negative consequence.
And what was the response you got?
Well, to the credit of the producers and the writers, they were interested in this conversation, and they were really pushed the interrogators. I mean, we were sort of surprised to learn they're in their sixth season, and they didn't spend a lot of time talking to soldiers and interrogators about the way that they do these things. So for them, this was a really interesting research opportunity. But it's also very difficult for them because they have a hugely popular show, and we were suggesting to them that they do something actually a little bit risky, which is change their format. And there's obviously a lot of money at stake.
Just reading from Jane Mayer's piece in The New Yorker, saying the show's villains usually inflict the more gruesome tortures. Their victims are hung on hooks like carcasses in a butcher shop, poked with smoking hot scalpels, or abraded with sanding machines. In many episodes, however, heroic American officials act as tormentors, even though torture is illegal under U.S. law. In one episode, a fictional president commands a member of his Secret Service to torture a suspected traitor, his national security advisor. The victim's jolted with defibrillator paddles while his feet are submerged in a tub filled with water. As the voltage is turned up, the president, who's depicted as a scrupulous leader, watches the suspect suffer on a video feed. The viewer, who knows the advisor is guilty and harbors secrets, becomes complicit in hoping that the torture works. A few minutes before the suspect gives in, the president utters the show's credo: everyone breaks eventually.
Yeah, it's a little disturbing. The show is in some ways an advertisement for torture. Torture works on 24. Works on a lot of other shows, too.
Tony Lagaranis, does torture work?
In my experience, no. I saw torture in Iraq. I even employed some torture methods. And in my experience, it doesn't work. I think that you're going to get false intelligence when you employ torture methods.
Now, Joel Cerno, who's the creator of the show, did not attend your meeting, and he himself has admitted to being a right-wing nut and a friend of Rush Limbaugh. Your sense that the show will change at all, or is your sense that he's really using his show to pursue a political agenda?
Well, as Amy mentioned at the top of the show, at the top of this segment, they have said that they are going to tone down on torture. And it is our hope that they will do this. It's not clear to me which direction they will go, but they've really been the leaders in showing torture in this graphic way and suggesting that it works. And we're hopeful that they'll now be the leaders in stepping back from that and doing what's really responsible.
I wanted to quote Kiefer Sutherland. He's the star. He's Jack Bauer. He makes, what, $10 million an episode. And he was asked by Charlie Rose about this. And Kiefer said, do I personally believe that the police or any of these other legal agencies that are working for this government should be entitled to interrogate people and do the things that I do on the show? No, I do not, he said. $10 million a year, sorry, is what Kiefer Sutherland makes. Tony Lagaranis, you said you personally were involved with torturing prisoners. What did you do?
Well, we used things like hypothermia, stress positions, sleep deprivation for long periods of time. I used military working dogs, sensory overload with music and strobe lights. These things were ineffective, and when people did talk, they either told us things that we already knew, or they tended to mislead us. A far more effective method of interrogation is elicitation, is getting the person to engage you and to speak to you at length. And that way, you know, if you get a large volume of information from the person, if they're speaking for a long time, you can use what they're saying to check their own information, to get them to contradict themselves, or to get specific details. With torture, you might get a confession, or you might get, you know, a single statement, and that's really very hard to verify in the interrogation booth what they're saying.
And David Danzig, when you approached Brigadier General Patrick Finnegan about this, had he been watching the show already? Was he familiar with it, or did you introduce him to it?
He was familiar with it, and in fact, one of the reasons that he was particularly interested in participating in this trip was that he and other educators, not just at West Point, but other people who taught interrogators who we have spoken to, have told us that in their classes, Jack Bauer comes up all the time. When I first talked to a colonel at West Point about this, he said, oh my God, 24 is one of the biggest problems I have in teaching my classes. Everybody wants to be like Jack Bauer. They all think that it may be possible, or there are times when you should have to cross the line.
According to Jane Mayer's piece on 24, it's a favorite of the White House. Cyrano, who calls himself the right-wing nut, has met with Karl Rove, as well as Tony Snow, and Mary Cheney, and Lynn Cheney, the wife and daughter of the vice president. Tony Lagaranis, what do you think of 24's response from your meeting with them?
Well, as David said, they were receptive, and they were more receptive than I thought they would be. They spoke to us for a long time. They didn't have to meet with us at all. But it's not a surprise that they were resistant to change.
Well, when you bring a general,
I'd like to add also that I think that a larger impact than what, how the interrogators or how the military is affected by 24, it's really affecting public opinion, too. I've been speaking about torture since I returned from Iraq, and people always bring up the ticking time bomb scenario, and they always bring up 24 as a reason why we need to legalize torture. The professionals, the professional interrogators don't want to torture. The military doesn't want to torture. The FBI doesn't want to torture. The CIA did studies, and they said that torture doesn't work and it produces false intelligence. Where is this idea coming from that we need to torture to combat terrorism? It's coming from the media, in my opinion.
Tony Lagaranis, did 24 offer you a job?
No, they didn't. No.
Well, I look forward to reading your forthcoming book. Tony Lagaranis, former Army interrogator. His book is called Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. And also David Danzig of Human Rights First. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Gokadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Richin, Aaron Matej, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.